Let's turn in our Bibles to Leviticus chapter 10. The book of Exodus, God instructed Moses and gave him the plans for the tabernacle. And the end of Exodus tells us that they had completed the tabernacle according to the plans. God had gifted certain men to their work. And now that the tabernacle is complete, the first eight chapters of Leviticus deal with the types of offerings that are to be made, how the sacrifices are to be made, and the purpose and the meaning of the various offerings. The first was the sin or trespass offering, because that was necessary. The whole idea, of course, is to bring man into fellowship with God. That's the whole idea and purpose of the offerings. Sin alienates a man from God. And the idea of the offerings was to lead him back into fellowship. And so the first offering that he describes is the sin or trespass offering. That has to be taken care of. Then there came the burnt offering, which was an offering of consecration or dedication of my life to the Lord. This was followed by the peace offering, which was the communion. With the peace offering, you got to eat part of it. It would be roasted on the fire. You and your family would sit down. And the idea is that now that the sin issue is taken care of, I've consecrated my life, I now can have this fellowship, communion with God. And so with the peace offering, I would sit down. Part of the fat and so forth would be offered to the Lord as a sweet-smelling savor. And then I would sit down and I would eat of it. And the idea is I'm eating with God and thus becoming one with God. In that culture, eating together with people was a very significant, meaningful experience. To eat with someone constituted becoming one with that person. And probably because of the way they would eat, they didn't have silverware at the table and plates and so forth, but they just had these sauces and soups on the table, and they would have the large flat bread, and they would just hand the flat bread around the table, and you'd pull off a hunk and you'd start dipping in the soups and in the sauces, and there was no rule against double dipping, and so it was just a thing of, by the end of the meal, you've shared your germs with everybody else at the table, and you've really become sort of one with them. In the idea that the bread that I have eaten is the same bread that you have eaten. The sauces that I have eaten are the same that you have eaten. And so this bread is now being assimilated into my body, becoming a part of my body, but it's being assimilated into your body. It's becoming a part of your body. So in a very mystic sense, we are becoming one. We're being nourished and strengthened by the same bread. This is why the Jew would never eat with a Gentile. This is why they found fault with Jesus, because they said he is eating with sinners and with publicans. And they were shocked that Jesus would eat with sinners and publicans. A rabbi would never do that, because he didn't want to be identified or become one with them. And so the peace offering, you sit down and I'm eating with God. What does that mean? I'm becoming one with him. And that beautiful thought of this communion, I'm becoming one with God. And that was the purpose of the sacrifices, to bring them into this awareness and consciousness of the oneness that they can experience with God. So all of the various offerings are explained in the first eight chapters of Leviticus. You get to chapter 9, and Moses is now putting on the holy garments on Aaron and on his sons, because they are now about ready to inaugurate. The tabernacle is here. We know the various offerings. And so we are now going to institute the whole process of man coming to God through the sacrifices in that were offered at the tabernacle and all. And so everything is in readiness. Everything is in order. Aaron is now crowned with the mitre, and he has got the breastplate on and the holy garments of the high priest. And we read that Moses and Aaron, and this would go back to chapter 9, Aaron lifted up his hand, verse 22, toward the people and blessed them, and came down from the offering of the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering. Brought them on in. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation, and they came out and they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all of the people. And there came a fire out from before the Lord, and it consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat, which when all of the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Here is a very exciting, dramatic moment. The sacrifices have been made. Man has been brought into fellowship. The fire of God, sort of as a confirmation of God's approval on the whole thing. The fire of God comes in spontaneous, kindles the fire on the altar, consumes the sacrifice. And when the people see this demonstration of God's presence, it's an exciting moment. They all fall on their faces. They're shouting. They're worshiping God. It's a moment of great spiritual excitement. And at this very time of great emotions and spiritual excitement, we read, and Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took both of them their censers, and they put fire therein and incense on it. And they offered strange fire before the Lord, which he did not command them. And there went out a fire from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said unto Aaron, "This is it that the Lord spake, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come near to me, and before all of the people I will be glorified." And Aaron held his peace. What is the strange fire that brought instantaneous death to the sons of Aaron? Is it possible that they were trying to take attention away from the Lord and sort of bring glory and honor to themselves? The people are excited. The people are worshiping God. It's a moment of God's manifested presence. And is it that suddenly they feel that, well, they need to know how important we are? Were they trying to draw the attention of the people away from God? You know, this oftentimes happens. I have seen it so many times when God's Spirit is moving in just a beautiful, glorious way, that someone will get up and let out a whoop or a scream, and suddenly we're all just, our attention is taken off of this beautiful awareness of God and the worship and all, and it's drawn towards this person who is making sort of an inordinate type of manifestation. And it's taking the glory from God onto an individual. Is that what Moses perhaps meant when he said, "This is what the Lord spoke"? And he's quoting now from the earlier portions, "I will be sanctified in them that come near to me, and before all of the people I will be glorified." I believe that the strange fire could be that drawing attention to yourself and glory to yourself that really belongs to God. As we mentioned last night, people have to worship. It's innate. They can't help themselves. We are driven to worship. It is difficult for many people to worship something they cannot see. But you were God's instrument, and through you, God did a work in their lives. They can see you. And so often, as Paul said, their foolish hearts are darkened, and they worship and serve the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forevermore. But the fact is, God will not share his glory with another. One of the most dangerous times in the ministry is when God has used you and the people begin to look at you as though it were something that you did rather than something that God did. Now, the real danger is if you take the glory or do things to draw attention. And it is easy for us to do things that would draw attention to ourselves and our filthy, rotten, horrible flesh delights in being worshipped. And we have to be careful lest we are doing things very subtly, but in such a way that it brings attention to us and glory to us rather than to the Lord. It's a serious matter when people are worshiping God and their hearts are focused upon God for someone to draw attention of the worshipers to themselves. It can be done through loud shouting. It can be done through many other things. I was in a church recently, and they had an outstanding worship team. And they had choruses that I did not know, but they were excellent. And I was trying to look at the, and unfortunately yours is high enough here, that, but these were lower on the platform in this particular church. And as I was trying to enter into the worship, reading the words of the choruses on these screens, suddenly people began to stand up in front of me. And I was trying to look around, and I couldn't sing anymore. I didn't know the words. And because they were standing in front of me, I couldn't see the words. So they may have been getting a blessing by standing there and sort of waving back and forth, but it sort of was a quench for me, because suddenly my attention was no longer on the words of worship, but I wish they would sit down. What are they standing up for when everybody else is sitting down? And I have to admit that my heart wasn't probably where it should be. I probably should have just closed my eyes and listened, but it sort of irritated me that I couldn't participate in the worship through the words of the choruses that they were singing. And I always wondered, why did they stand in the front row? And you know, when you want to get someone's attention, what do? You wave. And movement like that is always an attractive, it draws your attention. What's he waving about? Hey, fella. And these can be subtle ways by which you are drawing attention to yourself. But the moment you draw attention to yourself, you are taking attention away from the Lord. Paul tells us that God desires that no flesh should glory in his sight. Every once in a while, not often because I can't really handle it, but if my blood pressure is low, I will turn on Christian TV. And if you want a good example of what I'm talking about, watch how they try to upstage each other. Get in the camera angles. Get in the limelight. And that's exactly what Aaron's two sons were endeavoring to do. As the people are just moved, excited, God has manifested his presence. What a wonderful moment. These two guys grab their little incense burners. They put the fire in it. And they put the incense on. And they go in. Like, look how important we are to this whole thing that is happening. That's a possibility of the strange fire. A second possibility that I see in the scriptures is that perhaps there was sin in their lives. In Exodus 19:22, God said, "Let the priest also, which come near to the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them." Now the Lord had broken forth upon them. The fire came and consumed them. And thus, the warning when they were talking about, you know, when you are offering your sacrifice, make sure that you sanctify yourself. Make sure that your heart is right before God. In Lamentations, Jeremiah said, "It is the Lord's mercies that we are not all of us consumed, because his compassions fail not." Even the plate on the headdress that the high priest wore said, "Holiness to the Lord." There are some men standing in the pulpit today who are living double lives. They are God's representative when they stand in the pulpit before the people. But I'm surprised that fire does not come from heaven and consume them as they are standing there. Surely, as Jeremiah said, it's the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. Paul wrote, "I keep my body under. I bring it into subjection, lest having preached to others, I be cast away." How important it is to keep the body under. You see, man is a threefold being: body, soul, spirit. Man was created a threefold being: spirit, soul, and body. But upon man's disobedience, there became an inversion, and rather than spirit, soul, and body, he became body and soul or mind. The spirit died, as God said, "In the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." And that spiritual death was the loss of the consciousness of God. And they died spiritually, as far as the communion, the oneness with God that God created us for, that oneness with him. That died when they disobeyed the commandment of God. And now man is twofold being. He is body and mind, and the mind is now controlled by the body appetites. As Paul describes it in Ephesians chapter 2, and you were all by nature the children of wrath, even as others, as you were living according to the lust of your flesh and the lust of your minds. And so it's a mind that is controlled by the body appetites. And look at the world, the unconverted world around you, and you see that that's exactly what it is. They are people who are controlled by their body appetites. Their whole mind is on what? The things of the flesh, the things of the body. What shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? And the whole thing of the mind being consumed with sex in America today and all. But it's consumed by the body appetites. Now, when a person is converted, Jesus said, you've got to be born of the Spirit. You've been born of the flesh. You've got to have a spiritual birth. Don't marvel when I say you've got to be born again if you're going to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's got to be. But what happens when you have a spiritual birth? You back now as God created you. You are now again spirit, mind, and body. And the mind is now subject to the things of the Spirit. Paul talks about that in Romans 8. Now the mind of the flesh is death, but the mind of the Spirit is life and peace and joy. So, spiritually minded. But the flesh doesn't like living in the basement. And it is always struggling to be on top again. And so Paul describes this battle that we're going through there in Galatians, where the flesh is lusting against the Spirit and the Spirit against the flesh, and these two are contrary, so that we don't always do the things that we would. And there is this horrible battle that's going on. But Paul said, I keep my body under. Bring it into subjection. And it's literally, I beat myself till I'm bruised, bloody, black and blue, to keep the body under. It's a struggle, it's a fight, it's a war, it's a spiritual warfare. But it is so necessary for the ministry that we keep the body under, lest having preached to others, we ourselves would be cast away. Now, God is a superior Trinity. He's Father, Son, and Spirit. Man is the inferior Trinity, spirit, mind, and body. As the Spirit is uppermost, then a man touches God and comes into communion with God. It's in the realm of the Spirit that you experience God, in which you worship God. As Jesus said to the woman of Samaria, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. God doesn't come to your mind. He doesn't come to your body. He comes to your spirit, and there is where you are joined with God in the realm of the Spirit, and his Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are the sons of God. And so the importance of keeping the Spirit uppermost. NIV reads there in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. God holds the leaders to the higher standards. And so James warns, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing that you will receive the greater condemnation. The Lord said, who is that faithful and wise steward whom his Lord will make ruler over his household and give them their portion of meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom, when the Lord comes, shall find him so doing. Of a truth, I say unto you, that he will make him the ruler over all that he has. But and if that servant say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, And he shall begin to beat the men servants, the maidens, and to eat and to drink and be drunken. The Lord of that servant will come in a day when he is not looking for him, and an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him asunder, and will appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant which knew his Lord's will, but did not prepare himself, neither did according to his will be beaten with many stripes. But he that knew not and did not commit the things worthy of stripes will be beaten with few. For unto whom much is given, of him much shall be required. And to whom men have committed much, of him will they ask the more. So, a solemn warning by Jesus concerning his servants and the responsibility that knowledge brings. The one that knew the Lord's will but did not according to it beat him with many stripes. Yet he who did things that were worthy of many stripes because he didn't know will be beaten with few. Unto whom much is given, much is required. Paul laid out for Timothy the requirements for those that would take a position of leadership in the church. He said, this is a true saying. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. And a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality and apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker nor greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous. One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into the reproach and the snare of the devil. Jesus, speaking of the positions of rulership within his church, said to his disciples, now the Gentiles love to exercise lordship, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever will be great among you shall be your minister. Somehow we've gotten all mixed up on that word minister in our definition of it. How would you define minister? Well, the synonym is servant. Whoever would be chief among you, let him be the servant of all. And yet we come and we sort of expect people to carry our bags because, after all, I'm the minister. Let me go at the head of the table because I'm the minister. Give me a 10% discount because I'm a minister. And we've got the thing all wrong. I'm the servant. You don't go up and say, well, hey, I want the front line. I'm a servant here. How important that we remember that we are nothing more than servants. Servants of Jesus Christ, but as a servant of Jesus Christ, I am obeying him because he wants me to be servant of all. And how important it is. Strange fire, what was it? Was it their taking glory to themselves? Possibly. Moses surely hinted to that. Was it sin in their lives? Perhaps so. They were warned about that. But in verse 8, beginning with verse 8, we find another possible suggestion as to the strange fire. Spake unto Aaron, saying, do not drink wine, nor strong drink, you, nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of the congregation, lest ye die. It shall be a statute forever throughout all of your generations. The fact that this follows immediately upon the death of his sons is surely a strong hint that perhaps this was their problem. They were a little tipsy. They were tipsy to the extent that they could not have and did not have good judgment. They did things that they would have been inhibited doing had they had a clear mind. In fact, in verse 10, it goes on to say that you might put a difference between the holy and the unholy and between the clean and the unclean. As a minister of God, I feel that I am not to drink any alcoholic beverage or to take anything that would diminish my mental capacities or would deaden my mental capacities, would destroy my inhibitions. As again, Paul gave the rules for those that would be the overseers of the church. They were not to be given to wine. In the Old Testament, when a person wanted to really consecrate their lives completely to the Lord, they would take the vow of the Nazarite. And one of the portions of the vow of the Nazarite was they were not to drink wine. And so, the scripture does warn us that who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has babbling, who has wounds without cause, who has red eyes, they that tarry long at the wine, those who go to seek the mixed wine, look not thou upon the wine when it is red or when it gives its color in the cup or when it moves aright. There are those commentators that believe that that's describing the fermentation of the juice. Once it has become fermented and the alcohol content then is developed within it that he is warning about. At the last, it bites like a serpent, it stings like an adder. Your eyes will behold strange women. Your heart shall utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who tries to go to sleep in the middle of the sea. They have stricken me, you say, and I was not sick. They've beaten me, I know, I didn't feel it. And when I awake, I will seek it yet again. As Christians, I am aware that we have all kinds of liberty in Jesus Christ. In fact, several years ago, in a college course, I took a philosophy course, and the professor required that we write an article on ethics. And so I chose to write an article on Christian ethics because the professor had been making sort of derisive allusions to the narrowness of Christians and, you know, how the Christians, you know, are just so rigid and narrow and everything else. And so I thought that I would write an article on the Christian ethic. And I used Paul's declaration, all things are lawful to me. And I went on to say there is no ethic in all of the world that is as broad, as free as the Christian ethic. I mean, what ethic can you ever discover that says all things are lawful to me? But then I went on, and I pointed out that all things are not expedient. I am goal-oriented. I am pressing toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God. I am in a race, and they which run in a race run all, but only one receives the prize, so run that you might obtain. And because I'm running to win, if there are things that would slow me down, would hinder my running, I'll not do them because my goal is to win the prize. All things are lawful for me, but all things do not build me up. There are things that I could do, but they would tear me down. They would pull me away from my goals. And so wisdom dictates that I don't do those things that would not build me up, but would actually tear me down. And then all things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. And speaking then of the glorious Christian liberty that I have, I would be foolish to exercise that liberty in such a way as to bring myself into bondage. And if something has the potential of bringing me under its power, then it would be absolutely foolish. It would be the sacrifice of this tremendous liberty I have to begin to do something that would bring me under its power. And so, though all things are lawful for me, I will not be brought under the power of any. When a person is arrested for a DUI, what does that stand for? Driving under the influence. What does that mean? It means that he has an altered state of consciousness. There's enough alcohol in his brain that it has hindered the man's judgments, responses, reactions. And he is not under the full control of his faculties. Now, though it may be lawful, and I know that there are a lot of Christians that drink wine and they say, well, Jesus made wine at the marriage feast, and they try to justify it, but yet that is just a poor exercise of your Christian liberty, because it has the potential of bringing you under its power. My father grew up in a very wealthy home with the servants and all, and his parents were quite liberal, and they believed in training the children how to drink at the table. So with every meal, there was the wine, and the children were taught to drink in moderation. And their whole philosophy was, if they know how to drink, things will be all right. All of my father's brothers, all three of them, became alcoholics. My father was the only one that wasn't an alcoholic, and that's because he, when he accepted Christ, no longer drank. All things are lawful, oh yes, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Now, it all boils down to this. God does not want Christian service motivated by strange fire. And I have to confess that in my early ministry, I was guilty of seeking to motivate people with strange fire, to sort of hype them up for Christian service, to sort of hype them up through contest. The Reds against the Blues, the men against the women, and to develop these Christian contests and to give away all kinds of prizes. And one contest, we actually gave away a 37 Packard convertible. Oh, I wish I had that car today. One of the most successful contests we ever had. But the interesting thing, the Sunday after the contest closed, we were right back down to where we were when the contest began, but we were without a 37 Packard now. I am guilty of strange fire if I am trying to draw the people to notice me, to draw attention to myself, or to try to bring glory to myself. I'm offering strange fire. I am offering strange fire. If while I am ministering to others, there's iniquity in my own life. I'm offering strange fire if when I'm standing before the people, my mind is in an altered state of consciousness because I've been drinking or taking some drug that has caused me not to be clear in my thinking. There was one Sunday when I woke up on Sunday morning, I had an ear infection and it just was so painful. And so my wife said, well, honey, you better take a couple of aspirin. And I did. But I found that as I was standing there ministering that morning, that I wasn't as clearly focused in my mind, that I wasn't able to think as sharply, as clearly. I didn't feel the earache, but I just wasn't fully mentally sharp and alert. And I decided then, never again would I step in the pulpit, even having taken aspirin. I'll go through the pain because I want my mind to be as sharp and clear as possible when I am bringing God's word to the people. I want to be able to hear the voice of God. I want to be able to be led by the Spirit of God with all clarity. I suppose that it is only the grace of God that many ministers do not fall dead in the pulpit. And I must think that the lack of the immediate judgment is just God's grace. But never, never mistake and think that it is God's approval. The Word of God tells us that he that is often reproved, if he hardens his neck, will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. Being in the position that we are in, overseeing many ministers, tragically, every year, we see those that have been playing with strange fire eliminated from the ministry. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. If we sow to our flesh, of the flesh we will reap corruption. But if we sow to the Spirit, of the Spirit we will reap life everlasting.